Hello and welcome behind the marquee, the podcast where we talk about all things movies and everything that's going on inside the Michigan and State Theater in our little art house theaters in downtown Ann Arbor. My name is Nick Aldrink and I'm the programming and media coordinator for the Michigan State Theater and your host for this episode. This is going to be a different kind of episode because I am trying something new. In that it's just me. There will be no special guests, no roundtable discussions, just my voice in your ears talking about everything that was going on inside my brain as we programmed our upcoming summer classics series. So, if you are not familiar, Summer Classics has been an annual film series that takes place through the month, usually through the months of May or June through August, and it has been going on for well before I even started working for the theater, which began in about the fall of 2014. The theme is usually pretty loose, at least compared to the rest of the series that we program, and really is just dedicated to the films that that we think are most fun to see back in the theater with an audience. We even take the term classic to mean everything from silent films to the golden age of Hollywood to modern classics that have been released in the past decade, really just to give ourselves the most wiggle room to play anything that sounds fun and interesting to us. And I say us because, though I will mention how, at least what was my intention of picking the films in this series, but we do have a programming committee that also includes Sarah Escalante, our director of programming and marketing, who has been on the podcast multiple times, as well as Russ Collins, our executive director, our film booker out on the West Coast, who negotiates with the distributors for us, as well as Ellen Putney Moore and Alicia Panny from our development team. Ellen, of course, you heard in our Oscar discussion a couple months ago. There were a lot of great choices in the initial selection, but they helped me narrow it down to these 14. So let's dive right in. This year, our series runs from May 29th to September 5th, and we're kicking everything off with Lawrence of Arabia, playing Sunday, May 29th, and Tuesday, May 31st. All these will play at least twice. We're having them on Sundays at 1:30 and Tuesdays at 7:30. Now, a lot of films are celebrating decade anniversaries this year, and this is one of the biggest. Released in 1962, it's celebrating its 60th anniversary. And of course, I'm talking about David Lean's grand epic starring Peter O'Toole. And it's one of those films that, in my opinion, I think everyone should see on the big screen at least once in their lives, because cinematographer Freddie Young captured some of the most mesmerizing images in all of cinema. He did this by shooting with a Super Panavision lens on 70mm stock, and that has an aspect ratio of 2.2 to 1. And that's where we get these desert landscapes in gorgeous panoramas that are just so extravagant. There are moments like Omar Sharif's entrance. He materializes from a mirage on a camel. And then there's the famous edit that cuts from O'Toole blowing out the match to the bright red sky above the dunes. And it's moments like this that really make it movie magic at its most elegant. Just a few years prior, you had West Side Story that also shot on Super Panavision. And then just a few years later, it was Kubrick who used it for 2001 A Space Odyssey. So it's in great company there. I could go on and on about Lawrence of Arabia, but we have a lot to get to. But I would like to take a moment to address the controversial aspects of the film. So, like I said, it's 60 years old, but there are cultural aspects of the film that were done very poorly and were just as wrong then as they are today. The film was, in fact, banned from most Arab countries except for Egypt, as that's where Omar Sharif was from, for its depiction of the culture. And then there's the obvious fault in the casting of the great Alec Guinness as Prince Faisal, who they put in brownface. And so, like everything that we show here at the Michigan, we program this film for its artistic merit, as I've been talking about. But we also think that we can learn just as much about the film from its mistakes as we can its merits. And that's just as important as long as they're pointed out and discussed. This is a film that has inspired filmmakers and artists like George Lucas, Steven Spielberg, Catherine Bigelow, Frank Herbert, just to name a few who have named named this film as one of their favorites, and it will continue to inspire filmmakers and artists for years to come, and that's why it should be remembered. There's no such thing as a perfect film, and we're certainly not trying to make the case by programming this film and ignore the aspects of this classic that should be criticized. It deserves a lot more discussion beyond this little soapbox that I'm on now, but like I said, I have a lot to go through, so let's continue. Now let's talk about Charade, because what's a summer classic series without Cary Grant or Audrey Hepburn? This will be playing Sunday, June 5th and Tuesday, June 7th. This one is from director Stanley Donen, a name that may be familiar from films like Singin' in the Rain, which he is credited as a co-director with Gene Kelly, as well as Funny Face, also starring Audrey Hepburn, and which played at the theater a couple weeks ago for a member event. Now, it's jokingly described as the best Hitchcock film that Hitchcock never made. That's a quote that I've always heard about the film. I looked into it. I wasn't able to figure out who it's exactly attributed to. So if you know, send me an email. But it's not necessarily shot like a Hitchcock film, but it's a thriller with many twists and turns and the bait and switch. It has the wrong man element, or rather the wrong woman element with Audrey Hepburn. And it's driven by dark comedy with plenty of violence. And in regards to the violence, I would actually say it outdoes Hitchcock from time to time, because some of the murders and the gruesome elements that you see in this film are even beyond what Hitchcock was able to do, even for Psycho. But to make it all go down smooth, you got Cary Grant at his most charming, with the salt and pepper starting to come in, and Audrey Hepburn, who just lights up the screen in this Jackie Kennedy-inspired wardrobe. And then you have the kind of chemistry that you'd expect from two of the most attractive people in Hollywood. And that's despite their 25-year age difference, which reportedly made Grant so uncomfortable that he had to push the screenwriters to make clear references to their age difference. So I guess just to clear the air, as well as alter the dialogue so that Hepburn would come across as the, quote, pursuer rather than Grant. And so I would go on to say that this was the only film that they did together, but I would go on to say that they're one of Hollywood's best on-screen pairs. Out up there with Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn. And, you know, after Lawrence of Arabia, this will just be an easy way to drift into the rest of the summer classic series. So I'm really looking forward to seeing this little romp through the Paris area with you all. Now, next we have Star Trek The Wrath of Khan. That's playing June 12th through the 14th. I've made it clear in this podcast many times that I fall deeply into the Star Wars camp of the sci-fi nerdom. And so I've had a lot of fun putting episodes 1 through 6 back on the big screen. And I'll take credit for that, whether you like seeing the prequels return or not. But because of all this, I felt that we had to give the other franchise some love. And as Wrath of Khan is celebrating its 40th anniversary this year, this seemed like the most opportune time. This is widely considered to be the best of the classic Star Trek films, and it's a film often included in lists of the best sequels ever made. And we've got William Shatner, Leonard Nimoy, George Takei.
Oh my.
And more from the original cast back at their positions on the Starship Enterprise, along with Ricardo Montalban, who plays Khan. He returns from a guest appearance that he made on a 1967 episode titled Space Seed. I love this quote from Pauline Kael. She praised it as a bit of wonderful, dumb fun, and that's all it really needs to be. You're not really going to hear me wax poetic about Star Trek, but in regards to cinema, this series probably doesn't get the respect it deserves. They made great television, but I can't really put my finger on why the series never worked as well on the big screen. Again, Star Trek really isn't my bag. I enjoy what I've seen of it, but I don't know. I would be look forward to hearing from you if you have any thoughts of why no one really puts as much emphasis on the films as much as like Star Wars. Maybe Like, the best I can come up with is maybe it had more to say philosophically. Maybe it had too many ideas that translate to cinema. But again, I'm talking out of my expertise, so send your emails. Next, also celebrating its 60th anniversary this year is To Kill a Mockingbird. This will be playing June 19th to the 21st. Perhaps one of the best and most important literary adaptations of all time. Now, of course, Harper Lee's story is one told in schools every year across the country with a moral lesson and courage that has, I would say, gone largely unheeded for far too long. And not to get too political here, in the cast, you've got Mary Badham, or Badham, I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing it incorrectly, a scout who's the primary character, the unreliable narrator, as she's often described, and many other young cast members that didn't really continue their acting careers for very long. And then you got Brock Peters as Tom Robinson. He was also in Soylent Green, as well as Star Trek Deep Space Nine much later, and then Robert Duvall making his feature film debut as Boo Radley. But of course, the MVP is Gregory Peck as Atticus Finch, who won his first and only Oscar for the role. This depiction of Finch, who is probably one of literature's most respectable characters, it's a masterclass in its simplicity. And that's especially admirable in that this half of this film is a courtroom drama. It's a subgenre that drives acting to sometimes be unbearably thick. Now, the character is required to be cool, collected, and demand respect by his mere presence. That's how Harper Lee wrote this person. But the way that he sells this role is why this film succeeds. If you had anyone less than Gregory Peck, this film wouldn't be as memorable today as it is. And it's what makes that quote from Reverend Sykes, as played by Bill Walker, so powerful and endearing in the end.
Miss Jean Louise, stand up. Your father's passed.
Now, like Lawrence of Arabia, I need to take my soapbox again and say that I'm aware of its shortcomings as a film that tries to present a message on social commentary. Its depiction of racial divisions is a bit simple, and Atticus may fall too much into the white savior archetype, but it's a message that's, at least I believe, that's nevertheless earnest and heartfelt. And for that and everything previously that I mentioned, it's an important film to celebrate and to appreciate so many decades later. It may not even begin to address the complexities of today's racial divisions, but it's an important stepping stone to recognize. It's celebrating its 60th anniversary this year. It makes a welcome addition into our summer classic series. Next up, The Wiz, playing June 26th and 28th. The Wizard of Oz has been a long staple of summer classics, but this year we're switching things around. This is Sidney Lumet's 1978 adaptation of the 74 Broadway musical that reimagined L. Frank Baum's classic story. It stars Diana Ross as Dorothy, Michael Jackson as the Scarecrow, you got Nipsey Russell as the Tin Man, Ted Ross as the Cowardly Lion, and Richard Pryor as the Wiz himself. This was co-produced by Motown Productions with Universal Studios, and when this movie was released, it was the most expensive musical ever filmed, with a budget of $24 million. And it came as the blaxploitation movement of the 1970s was becoming mainstream. This is a movement that gained popularity with underground success of films like Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, Shaft, Superfly, Cleopatra Jones, among others. But after film was released, it bombed. Box Office Mojo reports a worldwide gross of $14 million. That is a $10 million loss. So unfortunately, it turned the industry away from future projects made with all-black casts, pretty much ending the blaxploitation movement entirely. Now, this was a movement that was controversial to begin with. Some scholars will debate its importance. Some scholars will debate it actually harmed African Americans in the industry and in American society in general. But its loss created this gaping hole in Hollywood that really wasn't mended until the rise of Eddie Murphy's career in the mid to late 80s, and filmmakers like John Singleton and Spike Lee 10 years later, when Hollywood only then really began to trust marketing films to black audiences again. But thankfully, the history of The Wiz it's endured. The original Broadway musical won seven Tony Awards, including Best Musical, so they had great material to work with already. And then adding the supervision of the legendary Quincy Jones on the soundtrack with some of Motown's best talent, it makes this one of the most whimsical and uplifting Broadway soundtracks around. Again, that's just my opinion. But if you want to give it a taste, if you're not familiar with the soundtrack or with this film, a few highlights are Ease On Down the Road. That's the version, that's the song that's probably most familiar to you. It's the film's version of Follow the Yellow Brick Road. And you've also got tracks like I'm a Mean Old Lion from Ted Ross, who's one of the only original cast members of the Broadway show to appear in a major way. Everybody Rejoice is another good one, which is an ensemble piece near the end. And then Diana Ross brings it all down with the finale Home. Now today, the film has been given a cult classic label, and in 2015 was revived by NBC for a live special with Queen Latifah in the titular role. So I'll go out on a limb to say that I don't think the story of this show is over, and we're just bound to see another revival of it sooner or later, whether it's on the stage or in another film adaptation. I don't know. We'll see. So I guess he's on down the road to the Michigan, and come see for yourself. Now, we had a taste of Hitchcock earlier in the series with The Charade, but coming up next, the first up in July, is Rear Window, playing July 3rd and 5th. Now, personally, this is my favorite from Hitchcock, and I found this quote from John Monahan of the Detroit Free Press that I think describes it best. This is from a review published in February of 2000. He says, "Sure, Vertigo is more personal, Psycho more bizarre, North by Northwest more thrilling, but Rear Window shows the master of suspense at his most spare, sophisticated, and sinisterly clever." I love that line. So in 1954, this is when Hitchcock's career was certainly well established. This was his 33rd sound film, and he had done 10 silent films prior to that. But this is when his reputation was just beginning to soar, and it hadn't quite reached his peak yet. Dial M for Murder, what came out just a few months prior to this one. And these are just his second and third films to shoot in color, the first being Rope, released in 1948. Rope and Rear Window, they of course share a lead in Jimmy Stewart, but this is also Hitchcock succeeding by making a thriller with a less is more formula, as they're both set in a single location. Here he lets his characters fear and neuroses, and in the case of Rope, ego, drive the suspense through dialogue and context alone. You know, Jimmy Stewart is confined to this wheelchair while he believes to witness a murderer living out his daily life across the alleyway, and he has nowhere to go, and he feels all he can do is watch and witness and piece things together through his camera lens. And Hitchcock drove this static nature of the plot by constructing the set that's like looking into a fishbowl and seeing different people living out their lives unaware that they're being viewed at all. Hitchcock loved the psychology of the voyeur that really came out later in Psycho. And the set is really fascinating because this is a beautiful Technicolor film. You know, you capture the bright blue sky and vibrancy of New York City in the summertime, but it was all a trick. All this was built on a Paramount lot. And it's Hitchcock at his most controlled. And this film, as a beautiful Technicolor classic, it helps... is that help drives the eeriness of this picture. You know, typically in horror, dark clouds and thunderstorms, they'll help cultivate a mood that allows for fear and jump scares. But horror that is set in a day is something different. I'm thinking of examples like Midsommar, or one of the most like frightening murder scenes I can think of in a film is David Fincher's Zodiac, where the killer randomly attacks a couple by the lake in broad daylight. It certainly makes the horror feel very real, and it's a technique that you don't see used in this genre often that Hitchcock displays very well. So this is one I could talk about all day. So I'm going to leave it at that. Let's move on.
Crank up those subwoofers, dude, and check this out.
Then we have The Lego Movie, July 10th and 12th. This is the most relevant example of the modern classic that I was talking about, and one that I truly believe is going to stand the test of time as one of the great family-friendly features of our era, with a little bit of something for adults and children alike. If you've seen it, you may know what I'm talking about, but if you haven't, if you're shaking your head because you think it just looks like a multi-million dollar advertisement to sell toys, then let me tell you a little bit about it. Though I suspect that probably that to sell toys was the underlying intention that first got the film greenlit, you would never really think that was the intention when watching the film. In fact, I would go as far to say that it dissuades viewers from buying their products, or at least their expensive kits that come with detailed instructions, because the ultimate message of this film is one that rather promotes creative imagination and urges kids to build what's in their heads rather than what's on the paper. The creative team behind this was Phil Lord and Christopher Miller, who became best known in 2009 for Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, and then even better known for 21 and 22 Jump Street a little while later, as well as the producers behind Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse in 2018. And for The Lego Movie, they pulled this cast that includes Chris Pratt, Will Ferrell, Elizabeth Banks, Will Arnett, Morgan Freeman, Liam Neeson, Nick Offerman, Channing Tatum, Jonah Hill, and so many more. Artistically, it's a fascinating movie to watch with so many details that easily go unnoticed, because though it's meant to look like stop motion that any kid can make at home, it's actually a hybrid model where the animators built their world literally brick by brick, but inside the computer, and then they animated it. There is nothing in the movie that is not designed with computer-generated Lego bricks, including the sky and the movement of water. Like I said, it's a fascinating flick to enjoy with your kids and encourage their creative imaginations, with plenty of jokes and references to Batman, Star Wars, and 80s pop culture to keep adults entertained as well. So I hope you give it a shot. So even before the passing of director Peter Bogdanovich earlier this year, I've been wanting to do a celebration of his work for some time. So as What's Up Doc is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year, we'll be playing it July 17th and the 19th. Bogdanovich is right up there with directors like Steven Spielberg, George Lucas, Francis Ford Coppola, Martin Scorsese, that were part of that new Hollywood movement of the late 1960s and early 1970s that gave power back to directors that was once held by studios and reintroduced this new evolved concept of authorship to cinema. His previous film, The Last Picture Show, I would say is a bona fide masterpiece that earned Ben Johnson and Cloris Leachman Academy Awards, and it feels even more important as small town life seems to keep disappearing, and little cinemas like the Michigan State Theater have become rare. But he followed that up with this one in 1972 that stars the indelible Barbara Streisand, along with Ryan O'Neill, who mashed this ode to classic screwball comedies of the 1930s, like Bring in a Baby, with Bugs Bunny cartoons, and created this, I'm going to use the word romp again, through the San Francisco Bay Area. So Where Last Picture Show was one that wanted to leave you thinking about your home and nostalgia and friendships or lovers of the past, this one was one that really had no interest in challenging the audience and rather just wanted to let you sit back and laugh. Streisand is really the one that makes this film work. She has this fast-talking, sharp-witted trickster element to her, channeling, you know, Bugs Bunny, who comes out of nowhere and charms Ryan O'Neill's character over, stealing him away from his fiance, played by Madeline Kahn, who made her feature film debut in this one. And it's a story of vibrant costumes of blues and reds and golds, which stands out in the middle of Last Picture Show and Paper Moon, which he followed this up with, both in black and white, and Paper Moon being another drama and testament to Americana of the past. And so if you haven't listened to TCM's first season of their podcast, The Plot Thickens, I highly recommend if you plan on coming out to see this film. It's 7 episodes of TCM host Ben Mankiewicz interviewing Bogdanovich about his fascinating career in Hollywood with all its ups and downs and tragedy that it involves. It's a great listen, and I think will be an excellent primer to seeing What's Up, Doc? Back on the big screen. Then we have Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, playing July 24th and 26th. This one really goes without much explanation or hype building for myself, I think. Stanley Kubrick broke ground with this black comedy satire of 1964 that took aim at the escalating tensions between the United States and Soviet Union. It was released 2 years after the Cuban Missile Crisis and was a scathing indictment of the world's leaders and their actions that seemed to assure global destruction. Now, one more time, we'd spent a lot of time discussing or programming our summer classic series. This one coming up first in one of the earlier drafts that I made last winter. So I just want to say that this selection was not chosen to comment or make light of recent events, but rather chosen for its reputation as one of the most poignant comedies ever produced. That's largely driven by the eccentric comedic style of Peter Sellers, who plays 3 different roles in the film. I put this in here, it sounds ironic now, but I put the film in here to lighten the mood of the summer classics. He has this ability to present an oddness that snuffs out the fear of its bleak premise. And he does this even while playing a literal Nazi, while also driving home the urgency of its message. It's just a masterclass in satire that only someone like Kubrick could pull off. And in the same vein of Rear Window, this was the beginning of peak Kubrick. He followed this up with 2001 A Space Odyssey in 1968. And at his disposal here, he had, you know, George C. Scott, Sterling Hayden, playing a highly exaggerated form of his typical characters to full comedic effect, and even James Earl Jones, who made his feature film debut. So hopefully we can have some fun with this one. That's why it's here. Also, as you may know from listening to the podcast, I'm a massive Beatles fan. I'm starting to, you know, show my hand in the summer classic series a little bit, and I'll take any opportunity to put this film back on the big screen as long as I know this Ann Arbor audience will appreciate it, and you always do. So we're playing A Hard Day's Night July 31st and August 2nd. This is Richard Lester's film, who framed this fictional glimpse into the lives of the Fab Four. Each starring as exaggerated versions of their profiles, their individual identities that are kind of prescribed to them by the media. This is mainstream British comedy at its cheekiest. It's just got these incessant one-liners and inside jokes that I think probably takes a couple viewings to get a decent grasp on, but when it clicks, it overrides any and all ineptitude that these four had for acting. I'll go as far to say that this is at least in the top 10 comedies ever made, and that's my opinion. I don't know, email me. Now, I say this typically under the opinion that if a joke has to be explained, it's probably not very funny. With this film, however, I make the exception. For instance, throughout, you'll hear Paul's grandfather, played by Wilfred Bramble, described as clean, which to my understanding is a reference to his role on the British program Steptoe and Son, in which the running joke is that he is a dirty old man. So in their way, they were poking fun at Bramble's own image that audiences were familiar with and turning it on its head. So this is a film that I learn more about every time I see it, especially when I'm with other people, and that's why it's always a blast to see it at the Michigan. And one day when it's available, I'll be sure to program help and give that film the same respect it deserves as well. And celebrating its 30th anniversary this year, we have Sister Act. This is playing August 7th and 9th. This is the music-driven comedy starring Whoopi Goldberg that came at the height of her stardom, just 2 years after she won the Academy Award for Ghost. So in this film, she plays a lounge singer who joins a convent after being placed in a witness protection program. Now, the 90s were ripe with original comedies. You had Groundhog Day, Home Alone, Clerks, etc., etc. But this is up there as one of the best. This is from Disney's Buena Vista Pictures, so it's in a family-friendly nature while not being explicitly aimed at kids, and it includes a terrific soundtrack with selections from Fontella Bass, Etta James, Isley Brothers, Smokey Robinson, and so much more. Now, you got Goldberg, you got Maggie Smith, who we're about to see another Downton Abbey movie very soon, you got Kathy Najimy, Harvey Keitel, among others, and what I think is best about it is that it portrays these nuns and this church with a certain amount of earnestness without having an overt religious message, and it has at the same time it has enough jokes to keep the comedy accessible to all denominations without seeming sacrilegious, and it never feels like it's judging anybody. So today, where the sense of a gray area in both in politics and culture is rare, it's very refreshing, and it uses gospel music in such a delightful way that makes it feel fresh and enlightening. This film not only spawned a sequel, Sister Act 2, Back in the Habit, which was released just a year later, with all but Keitel coming back, and it was also adapted into a Broadway musical in 2006, and rumor has it there's an upcoming Sister Act 3 to be released on Disney Plus at some point in the future, with at least Whoopi seemingly confirmed to return, but we don't really have a lot of news on that, so I guess stay tuned. But this pick was for the series was actually an idea that came from Sarah Escalante, so be sure to thank her if you're excited to see it back on the big screen. She has this great story of visiting Rome and seeing a group of nuns. I believe she said that they are from a nearby church, but I could be getting the story all wrong. She saw them perform music from the film out on the street, and it was a great time. So yeah, I'll let her tell the story maybe next time she's on the podcast, and or ask her about that yourself. But like a few of these picks in the series, I'm just excited to push some great music in our theaters this summer. Dancing is always encouraged as long as you're not disrupting someone's view or experience. Okay, again, what more can I say about The Godfather that hasn't been discussed to death? It's playing August 14th and 16th, and another that I would say everyone should see in the theater at least once in their lifetime. This is Francis Ford Coppola's mafia drama that tops so many lists of the greatest films ever made, and even if you don't agree with that take, you certainly can't deny its effect on Hollywood that changed the way we looked at crime films, film epics, and movies forever. This has been on many summer classic lineups, and now we program it at the heels of Coppola finally earning his Hollywood star on the Walk of Fame, as well as the release of the new Paramount Plus series, The Offer, which details how the film came to fruition, and so many 50th anniversary retrospectives. So it would be a complete miss if we didn't include it again, but let's move on. Like I said, I don't think there's much more to say on this one. Surprisingly, the Coen brothers have remained mostly absent from our summer classics of the past, at least since I've been here. That may be because, though they are always funny, or at least humorous, they're a bit dark. But I grabbed the one, the sunniest and the silliest of their filmography, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which will play August 21st and 23rd. Now, the Coens have produced many films with great soundtracks. They typically work with T-Bone Burnett, but this film is on another level, which at times balances on the cusp of becoming a flat-out musical. You know, they take inspiration from Delta Blues and the Depression-era South. Staples of gospel and bluegrass and folk music like Big Rock Candy Mountain, which opens the film, as well as You Are My Sunshine. But the real hit of this film is their rendition of Man of Constant Sorrow. This is performed by, it's credited toward for the Soggy Bottom Boys, which is the fictional band in the movie. But in reality, they were just, I believe they're just a band of studio musicians whose vocals were dubbed over George Clooney in the feature. A little history about Man of Constant Sorrow. It's credited to Dick Burnett, who is a fiddler from Kentucky, who published the song in 1913. And it wasn't popularized until later by the Stanley Brothers, as well as covers from Bob Dylan, Joan Baez, Peter, Paul, and Mary, and many others of that 1960s folk wave. And also included on the soundtrack of this film, you've got selections by Emmylou Harris, Alison Krauss, and Gillian Welch. So you've got a lot of different voices for your hearing pleasure. But most importantly, the music is so important in this film because it plays an important part in setting the atmosphere, because as soon as you hear the banjo twangs and the melodies and the songs from the Juilliard Chang Gang, it sets the impression instantly of who these people are and what the times are like that they're living in. And then you got Roger Deakins' cinematography, which is also very important, like most of the Coen Brothers projects. And the editors added this golden, sometimes sepia hue layer to give the atmosphere that look of southern humidity, which again puts you in a time and place to understand where they are. And again, if you haven't seen this film before, I just want to drive home the silliness of this story. It's loosely based on Homer's The Odyssey, in that it meanders quite a bit as they're on this journey. But kind of like What's Up, Doc? It's a humor that takes inspiration from classic screwball comedies of the 30s and 40s, as well as films like Sullivan's Travels, the 1941 film from a director, Preston Sturges, starring Joel McCrea and Veronica Lake. And in that film, McCrea plays a director who wants to make his next film about, quote, the plight of the downtrodden. So he selects this novel titled Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which is where the Coens chose the title of their film from. So like most of Coen's best work, there's a lot to discover in their inspiration and homages. And leading the charge is a cast pulled from the Coens' typical repertoire. I already mentioned George Clooney in his first time working with them, but you've also got John Turturro from Barton Fink and Miller's Crossing and The Big Lebowski, Holly Hunter of Blood Simple and Raising Arizona, Charles Durning of Hudsucker Proxy, and John Goodman, who is in most of their great films. And then you've also got recognizable faces like Tim Blake Nelson, who later worked of them in the Ballad of Buster Scruggs. So this is going to be another one, a fantastic soundtrack to tap our feet to in the main theater. I hope to see you there. And so as summer wanes and Ann Arbor gets that feeling of football season in the air, we'll close the Summer Classics at the Michigan with Remember the Titans. It's going to be playing August 28th and 30th. This is the touching, family-friendly drama from Disney that came out in the year 2000. For me, this film was important, and for probably like so many others in my generation, because it introduced us to the music of Marvin Gaye and the Temptations and Cat Stevens and Bob Dylan and the Hollies and so much more. It stars Denzel Washington with a cast that includes a very young Ryan Gosling, as well as, you know, Donald Faison and Hayden Panettiere. It tells the story of this Virginia high school, their football team in 1971, And they're bonding after the initial conflict of schools integrating. It's, again, for a certain generation, this film was really important because we had never seen this history played out in such a mainstream, accessible way. And I think it will continue to be that entry point for generations to come. As popular as it was, it didn't receive any Academy Award nominations, but it did take home a slew of other awards, like an NAACP Image Award for Outstanding Motion Picture, and Denzel Washington took one home for Outstanding Actor in a Motion Picture, and Hayden Panettiere won a Young Artist Award for Best Supporting Actress, and then it's included on many other lists, like Best Football Movies of All Time. In 2006, was nominated in AFI's 100 Years, 100 Cheers category. And so come out and cheer with us in August as we say goodbye to summer at the Michigan Theater. But before it all comes to a close, we'll have to conclude the series the way we always do with Casablanca, celebrating its 80th anniversary this year. And for that reason, we're giving it a weekend of showtimes at the State Theater, playing September 2nd through the 5th. There really may not be another film out there that has more iconic one-liners. You know, you got, "Here's looking at you, kid," "We'll always have Paris," "Play it, Sam," "I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship." But that came from a screenplay that was based on an unproduced stage play called Everybody Comes to Rick's by Murray Burnett and Joan Allison, who are a husband and wife who wrote it after a vacation in Austria that turned sour due to the growing anti-Semitism in Europe. But by the time it was released, it was just a year after the attack on Pearl Harbor, and one of the first major Hollywood productions to address the war and take a side in the matter, because before Pearl Harbor, the United States was controversially, depending on who you talk to, neutral in the entire conflict. Though the box office was pretty modest, of course, we know it today as one of the greatest films ever made. In 1943, it took home the Academy Award for Best Picture, Best Director for Michael Curtiz, Best Screenplay for Julius and Philip Epstein, and with Howard Koch and Humphrey Bogart and Claude Rains were both nominated for Best Actor and Best Supporting Actor, though they lost to Paul Lucas for Watch on the Rhine and Charles Coburn for The More the Merrier, respectively. But I'll let you look those up. But unfortunately, Ingrid Bergman was not nominated. I'm not sure if that was a snub or not, but it certainly seems like it today. But of course, what we love most about this film and why we're celebrating at the State this year is because the State is also celebrating its 80th birthday this year. We had a celebration for it on March 18th, just over a month ago. So I think I speak for all of us at the Michigan Theater Foundation that it's an honor to remain at our spot on State Street for all these years. And we're so thankful for to have such a supportive community as Ann Arbor, who has held with us through so many different changes and designs. It is going to be a celebration like no other to have this weekend of Casablanca at the State. So I hope to see you there. And that's it. Whew, okay, that was our summer classics this year. If you want to check out our lineup for yourself or to buy tickets in advance, just go to mitchtheater.org/summer-classics. Thank you all for listening. Please let me know what you thought of this experiment of an episode. I'll probably be doing more like this in the future with just me on the mic, as you know, everyone's so busy right now. So email the show at btmpod@gmail.com. Let me know your thoughts. Meanwhile, be sure to follow the Michigan State Theater on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Those can be found at Michigan Theater and at State Theater A2. And that's theater spelled with an R-E. Of course, be sure to subscribe to the podcast and give us a 5-star rating so that we can catch the ears of more listeners. Thank you to Matt Gauntlet of the Ann Arbor District Library for making sure these episodes drop on a timely basis. The theme you're listening to right now is Keith Manfield's Morning Broadway, a classic library catalog recording. One more time, thank you for listening and joining us behind the marquee.